everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the demand for a new spiritual ethics to face climate change and our ecological crisis, and how to find an authentic and purposeful life amidst planetary uncertainty. My guest on Skype from Colorado is David Loy. David has spent his life as a professor, a philosopher, an ethicist, even a Zen Buddhist teacher, and a prolific author. He has taught philosophy at a university in Japan, where he lived for 20 years, studying with his principal Zen teacher, Yamada Koin Roshi, and received Dharma transmission to be a teacher. Later, he was the chair professor of ethics and religion at Xavier University in Cincinnati. He has taught at the University of Cape Town, Hebrew University in Israel, and later resident scholar at the Naropa University in Boulder, Colorado. His articles frequently appear in Rabbi Michael Lerner's Tycoon magazine and Buddhist magazines, such as the Tricycle and Lion's Roar. And he sits on the advisory boards of Buddhist Global Relief and Zen Peacemakers and the Ernest Becker Foundation. He's earned degrees from different universities, and including a doctorate from the National University in Singapore, and where he was a senior tutor for 6 years. And his latest book is Echo Dharma, Buddhist Teaching for the Ecological Crisis. His website is davidloy, that's L-O-Y.org. Nice to have you with us, David.
Thank you, Gary, and very happy to be back.
David, because of my background, virtually 50 years in alternative medicine and public health, human nutrition and environmental studies, and as an activist, a conservationist, the first certified organic farmer in New York with the Fertiller Farm, created the first food co-op on the East Coast, animal sanctuary, over 3,000 animals we've rescued and brought back to life. My whole life has been spent involved in seeing nature for what it is, trying to live sustainably with nature, not against it, not abusing it or exploiting it. But in the process, I've seen so much happen that has brought me great concern. I believe that our current climate and ecological crisis is based upon primary paradigms. Capitalist paradigm is just one example, and a consumerist paradigm where everything is about consuming and overconsuming. Much like the dominant medical paradigm that says if you get sick, here is a pill or surgical procedure to treat it. But as we discovered increasingly, there is more often than not, there is a serious adverse effects from relying solely upon medical technology as the sole solution to our illnesses. Clinical medical practice largely ignores other factors such as the health benefits of reducing stress, spending more time in nature, green time, air or breathing, tree breathing in the forest, having a healthy diet, detaching ourselves from the causes of our negative emotions, changing our detrimental habits, acquiring a positive outlook on life, nurturing happiness and joy, spending time in nature, and many more. We also know that, and it's unfortunate that we haven't learned this lesson earlier, that there should be multiple approaches to any problem. It shouldn't be the proprietary exclusive domain of one discipline. So share with us, if you will, the idea that we are more than just a body-mind, that we're more than a reductionistic concept, and the role of our thoughts, our emotions, the power of our intention in the healing process, and also looking at the state of our world's ecosphere similarly. Or take us through that process to begin our discussion, please.
Well, big questions, Gary, and I think exactly the right ones. So often the ecological and indeed social situation that we find ourselves in now is understood in a very narrow way. In particular, when you look at the eco-crisis, people so often understand the solution as some kind of techno-fix. And I think what you're pointing to, and this is certainly, you know, consistent, I think, with fundamental Buddhist teachings, is the realization that the kind of issues we face today, such as global heating, are really just symptoms of a more fundamental problem, which I guess I would express in terms of our basic relationship to the earth, that it's not simply a matter of inventing some new technology that will enable us to continue with the kind of industrial growth, consumer-oriented society we have today, but rather what's challenged is the paradigm behind that and fundamentally the sense of separation that we seem to experience from the earth today. Maybe the first thing to say there is looking at global warming, global heating, although inevitably, to a large degree, we have to focus on that because that's so urgent. But nonetheless, that's really just a tip of the iceberg of a much larger crisis. I mean, one example that really stands out, of course, is the fact that we are now experiencing what's called the sixth extinction event, where a very large percentage of the Earth's plant and animal species are in the process of disappearing. In the history of the Earth, there have only been five previous events, and all of those, with the exception of the one that caused the disappearance of the dinosaurs, all of those events were caused by, in fact, greenhouse gases that led to, you know, pretty dramatic transformations in the Earth's atmosphere. What's happening now? I'm reminded of E.O. Wilson, the renowned Harvard biologist, who a few years ago made the prediction that by the end of this century, perhaps half of all plant and animal species on the Earth will be extinct or be so weakened that they will go extinct soon thereafter. Obviously, climate change has a lot to do with that, but that's not the only issue. It also deals with loss of habitat, for example. And there are many, many other issues that stand out here, plastics in particular, for me. It's a sobering thought to realize it's only during my lifetime, and I would think yours too, Gary, where plastics have been available on a commercial level. And within that one lifetime, I mean, we've managed to pollute so many corners of the earth, including even down in the deepest trenches of the ocean. Plastics, for the most part, don't degrade except in the sense that they split up into smaller and smaller particles. And what we're finding now is that they're everywhere, including our own bodies, including in our own drinking water. And as you mentioned in your introductory remarks there, we're also facing a situation where so many other toxins are really surrounding us everywhere. In the air, I'm living here just outside Boulder, Colorado, and we have extraordinary poor air quality, largely because of the oil and gas fracking industry, which is very large around here. But in addition to that, you know, all of the chemicals that have been produced and released into agriculture, into the air, into the earth, into the water, into our bodies, all of which I'm mentioning because the fundamental problem is much bigger than just the fact that the atmosphere is heating. What it really points to is a fundamental challenge to our way of experiencing our relationship with the earth, a fundamental challenge to the paradigm whereby we tend to understand our situation as a species that's separate from the earth, and that therefore, a species whose well-being can in some way be distinguished from the well-being of the Earth, rather than understanding ourselves as one of its species, one of its experiments, one of the ways in which the Earth is manifesting itself, and as I would say, one of the ways in which the Earth is becoming more aware of itself, more conscious of itself. I think this has extraordinary implications for the whole direction of our civilization. I think that because we feel separate, this has implications for the whole direction of our civilization. It's as if we don't know why we're here on the Earth. In contrast to so many previous civilizations where they felt that they had a role to play, we really feel that because we're mere accidents of the biological evolutionary process, that we basically have no function, no meaning to or role to play, except to enjoy ourselves if we can, while we can, as long as we can, rather than seeing ourselves as part of the Earth and therefore perhaps having a responsibility to it. How significant it would be, what an extraordinary change it would amount to if we could understand ourselves as I was saying earlier, one of the ways in which the Earth is becoming more self-conscious and therefore understanding our role on this Earth as not just pursuing our own selfish goals, increasing industrial growth, technological development, economic growth, and so on, but if we could understand our role as, because we feel a part of the Earth, working as well as we can to promote the well-being of all of its species. It seems to me that there's kind of a natural solution to that problem if we can only realize our non-duality with the Earth, which is where something like Buddhism comes in. It really seems like rather than a religion that reassures us that if we simply do what we're told, that we'll have some kind of afterlife salvation in a better place, if we can have a spiritual path that involves realizing more directly our non-duality, our intimacy with the Earth, and therefore its our sense of responsibility to it. And that's really getting at what I think Buddhism, for example, is pointing at. Not only Buddhism, of course, but I think Buddhism is one good example of that, where the kinds of contemplative practices that we engage in when we're on the Buddhist path involve letting go of our sense of separate self, opening up to the wider whole, realizing our interdependence, our interconnectedness with everything. It just seems to me that the kind of challenges that we're facing right now, socially, economically, politically, and especially ecologically, they're really calling for this, that this needs to be understood as the fundamental problem. And if we don't really find a way to address it, it's very possible that everything else we do won't really have much of an effect. I'm especially reminded here, I'm going to offer one of my favorite quotations by the Indian Neo-Vedantin teacher, Nisargadatta. I mean, he sums it up so well when he said, "When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love." I think he's getting at something important there, you know, the wisdom of realizing our non-separation, that my well-being isn't separate from the well-being of others, and our human well-being isn't separate from the well-being of the Earth. And the love that he refers to, it's not an emotion or a feeling, but it's really a way of being that we integrate into how we, you know, relate, so that we're not, so that our ultimate values and purposes and intentions aren't about, you know, what's in it for me, but looking at the larger whole, realizing that insofar as we're part of that larger whole, that our concern and our responsibility is to work for its well-being.
Our planet is suffering. Mm. The atmosphere is toxic. Humans are acting like viruses destroying our forests and grasslands. Our rivers, lakes, and oceans are reaching levels that won't sustain life. Mm. Our contaminated soil is threatening food security for the future. This is all due to human activity, yet our dominant culture tells us that the only solution will come from human technological ingenuity. The problem is that the system that created the problems remain in place. The dominant players, the United States, China, India, Brazil, are the major polluters in the world. We only address these crises by attending conferences, a climate conference in Copenhagen or Paris. And are they successful? As media, yes, it's very successful. Thousands of people can say we're doing something for the environment. We had meetings. We met with leading environmentalists and ecologists. And then I ask a simple question. Then why aren't you all vegans? Why are you still flying in private jets or flying at all? Why haven't you reduced your consumption to what you need, not just what you want? Have you developed an ethical sense of purchasing products? Have you looked at what you can grow locally, organically, sustainably, to reduce the carbon footprint? And more often than not, you get a response that is, look, we're going to solve our problems. We have the best technology in the world. And Silicon Valley and others are going to find a way to stop and even reverse the manifestation of global warming. And I say, but the problem is far more than global warming. The problem is overconsumption. When China is building the largest city the world's ever known, which will be a habitat for nearly 400 million people, imagine with a 300% increase in the consumption of meat, how much land they will be using, how many sentient beings, adding on to the 80 billion each year that are raised now to consume, to be consumed, then what is the solution when you are the world's largest polluter? Not a word is uttered by any politician about the responsibility of the military-industrial complex, and yet it is the number one polluter. You will see no one on American television or Canadian television or French television or English television telling people we're overconsuming. We're buying products with obsolescence. Shouldn't we buy what we need and have it purchased locally from people who, wherever possible, made it locally? Do we need all the things we have? And yet, that is not addressed at these conferences. And I'm very concerned because this is a green capitalism. It is still asking the market, the free market, to find the solutions. And I don't see that they're going to have any solutions that are going to make a difference, especially since they're also contributing to the problem. Your thoughts, please.
I think that's exactly right. That's where we need to begin. That it's really crazy to address the problem merely in a technological way without looking at our own carbon footprint. And for what it's worth, this is very much consistent with Buddhism, you know, which emphasizes looking at ourselves, looking at the way our minds work, and looking at the way that they affect and often determine we live in the world. At the same time, it seems to me that there's an institutional dimension which needs to be addressed as well. And it's not just a matter of technology, but it's the fact of the corporations and the kind of governments that they buy and control, the way that they really, with their advertising, with their conditioning, they encourage us to understand ourselves in terms of consumption, to understand the meaning of our lives as, you know, how much we earn and how much we spend. I'm reminded of something Bill McKibben wrote in an Orion article some years ago, where he said, you know, even if 10 to 15% of us were to, you know, reduce our carbon footprint as much as possible, and I think he was understanding it in an extreme way, maybe getting off the grid, maybe getting rid of cars altogether, using bicycles and so forth. He made the point, and I think there's a lot of truth to it, that the implications of that or the impact of that would be quite minor unless a significant percentage of those people also became politically engaged, because we need to accept the fact that we have very powerful institutions that benefit from the consumerism that they promote, and that they're going to do whatever they possibly can to continue promoting it unless they are limited by government action. So although reducing our own carbon footprint is absolutely necessary as a first step, I don't see that as sufficient. I'm reminded of the old sociological paradox. People create society. That is to say, society is simply the way that you and I and everyone else, the way we interact with each other. But also society creates people in the sense that there are institutions that tend to mold us, tend to make us understand ourselves, that impose their worldview upon us because they benefit, because they profit from the way things are going now. So it seems to me that that dimension really needs to be addressed as well. Within the Buddhist world, for example, and I come back to that because that's my own training, and that's the kind of vocabulary that I'm most sort of familiar with. Buddhism talks a lot about our fundamental problem individually as due to what it calls the three poisons or the three roots of evil: greed, ill will, and delusion. And I think it's important for us to realize in the modern world how much it is that we've institutionalized them. So the problem with capitalism, for example, as the predominant form of industrial growth society, is that as the predominant way of organizing ourselves economically, it encourages us to be greedy, and it also has institutionalized greed in the sense of its own preoccupation with never-ending growth, you know, so that it has built within it the tendency to promote that. I mean, people who advance in a corporation are the ones who are going to be supporting that kind of concern. And it works both on the individual level, that is to say, people are encouraged to understand their own advancement in terms of their own personal greed, but also the institution takes on a life of its own, so that quite apart from the motivations of the individual people involved, which, you know, those people can be changed pretty quickly as needed, the institution tends to grow and dominate. And that's why I think we can't ignore the political dimension. Certainly, technology by itself is not going to save us, but also we really need to be thinking about how it is that we can work together to address that. And I have to say, I think that there's been a significant shift of consciousness in the last year, and I'd be interested in your take on this too, Gary, where it seems to me, perhaps partly in response to the IPCC, the UN organization on climate change, they've warned us that we only had 12 years left. Well, actually, they're a pretty conservative organization, so if they say that, it's probably a lot less in terms of the situation that we're in here. But whether it's due to their statement or not, it seems to me a lot more people are a lot more aware of what's happening, of how difficult, how dangerous our situation is, how late it is, and also the sense that the present economic and political systems that we have simply are not going to be able to respond adequately unless somehow we find ways to hold their feet to the fire. So, for example, I have to say personally, I've been very inspired by this new development, Extinction Rebellion, which a couple of months ago actually sort of closed down central London for already a week, and it's already sort of spreading around the world. I mean, I think this is really moving in the direction that we need, the emphasis on nonviolent direct action in response to the kind of situation we find ourselves in. And of course, that's not going to be sufficient by itself. We need a fundamental change of paradigm, but we have to put pressure on the authorities in order to make them respond and to move in that direction. It's not going to be sufficient just to pass new laws. We need to find ways to look at and to sort of build new paradigms, new ways of thinking, new worldviews. But those have to be expressed politically as well as in our own individual consumption habits and lifestyles.
Around the world, there are younger people, especially those just entering college, who are rediscovering the deeper meaning and purpose with respect to climate change. The Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg has mobilized over 1 million youth. They started by taking a day off, a strike from school on Fridays. And yet she started just a little over a year ago just by herself, standing outside of her school. She inspired people. She was brought to the United Nations. She was brought to many of the world conferences. Now, many of those youth are unafraid to protest, even to be arrested. And I believe that they're important in addressing our ecological crisis, because that can be turned into a catalyst for the younger generations to rediscover a higher meaningfulness and thereby live a more authentic life. At the same time that she was advocating for millions to take to the streets in Europe, and they did, we were told that we would see similarly millions go to the streets in the United States, and especially at the United Nations. I took my camera crew there, and indeed there were people who showed up to join her. They were young people, a 12-year-old with her mother and three friends. That's it. That was all that showed up. So then the question is, do we really have a full awareness of the consequences of what happens when a society lives beyond the capability of the planet and its resources to provide a sustainable existence? How much do these people know in the United States, where a great deal of effort and money is being spent to deny the reality of climate change? It's not just about global warming. That's a major problem. Just imagine that France had the hottest days in their history in July of 2019, as did communities in India. The sixth largest community city of 10 million inhabitants in India has run out of water. I mean completely out of water. And yet, it couldn't have been a surprise. Wasn't there any preparation? Wasn't there discussions? Evidently not. Even now, the officials are denying how severe the situation is. But it's very severe for the people who are affected. The acidification of our oceans, commercial farming that is using artificial fertilizers, which are being taken into the Mississippi and Missouri and Ohio rivers, and then washed down to the Carolinas and Louisiana and Alabama, and ultimately into the Gulf of Mexico, creating the largest dead zone that we've ever seen. But all around the world, there are dead zones. Ask the average person, what do you know about a dead zone? Ask the average person, what happens to chemicals that go into the water and algae blooms? Ask how many people understand that we're losing 200 species every 24 hours. 90% of the large fish of the ocean are gone, and they're not coming back. The ocean's been overfished purely for supplying people with their food. We have taken large sections of the Amazon, and the Amazon is the lungs of the planet, and we have stripped large sections bare to grow genetically engineered seeds, soybeans that can be shipped off to China so they can then feed it to their pork and beef, so they can have more meat for consumption. So exactly how are we supposed to change if the dominant culture continues to remind us that we have everything we need because we have such advanced technology, and our blind faith in the ingenuity of science to cure all of our problems and the adverse effects of our psyches and spirit by being oversaturated with information and data, and a media full of faux and crass images? how do all these further isolate us from our true nature, and what kind of relationship should we have to our world that these obsessions are alienating us from? Your thoughts, please.
Well, having lived overseas in places like Singapore and Japan for most of my adult life, it's interesting to have a rather different perspective from what's going on than, say, just within the United States. It's worth emphasizing that one of the ways in which we are distinctive here in the U.S. is to the degree that people are ignorant and in denial of what's happening ecologically. And there's a reason for that, that there has been a concerted effort by various corporations, including some of the most important fossil fuel corporations, to obfuscate the facts and to raise doubt in people's minds in a way that will allow them to continue to operate and produce the kind of fossil fuels and burn the kind of fossil fuels that has been releasing carbon into the atmosphere. So, for example, we now know that even way back in the 1970s, Exxon knew more at that time more about climate change and the effect of carbon than anybody else did. But rather than come out and announce it and make some efforts to have us respond accordingly, the tendency was, of course, to suppress that information. And not only that, but to actually actively fund, often secretly fund, organizations that were denying or raising questions about the scientific findings. And again, the process comes back, I think, to, you know, their realization that if people realize really what was happening, then that would affect their profits, right? I mean, at that time, their money was and still is made from their access to oil, their ability to access it and sell it. And so they weren't interested in a new kind of a paradigm. And to a large extent, I think we're still facing the same problem today. It's interesting that it's not only that climate denial is well funded, but that the truth is people don't want to think about it. It's a distraction. It makes people feel uncomfortable, and we don't want to feel uncomfortable. And that's why the media, too, which are mostly corporate, they don't want to talk about it because it depresses people. It reduces their ratings, and therefore it has an impact on their advertisers. So for the most part, we haven't had enough emphasis on the part of the media because they have been concerned. I mean, the media are large corporations, and they make their money by finding ways to grab our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder, that is to say advertisers. And they don't see that as very compatible with alarming people about just how bad things are. And then when you add to that, of course, politics. I mean, politicians in the United States, for the most part, they're concerned about the next election. They're concerned about where they're going to get the money to pay for their next campaign. And it's not usually from individuals. Or at least not most individuals. It's from very, very wealthy people and corporate donations. That's where they're really going to get the money they need to get reelected. And they don't want to talk about climate change either. So we have a whole system of denial here, which I think is very much connected to the fact that our primary orientation is around economic growth that involves consumerism. That's really at the heart of it. And the challenge of not only climate heating or the climate emergency, but also the larger ecological crisis, is that it really it threatens that whole paradigm. It's basically saying we can't go on like this. It's based on a misunderstanding of our relationship to the Earth, and it can't go on indefinitely. And yet it's not surprising, of course, that there's a great deal of resistance at the top, because frankly, the people who own and or let me put it this way. The people at the top of the political system are, for the most part, the people who are also at the top of the economic system as well. And they are the ones who benefit most from the present system, and therefore they are the ones who are less inclined to make really fundamental changes. And although they'll see that some changes need to be made, it's very hard for them to see that there's a fundamental worldview, a fundamental paradigm that's at question here. And so one of the things that I'm finding encouraging about something like Extinction Rebellion and Greta, who, by the way, has also spoken to Extinction Rebellion XR groups, is the way that this is really trying to find a way to challenge all that. I mean, what I think it's coming to, frankly, Gary, is more and more of us are feeling that our backs are against the wall, and that as the way the present economic and political systems are functioning, they're not going to do what's necessary. And so the kind of large nonviolent protests such as our beginning, and I think our beginning in the U.S. too, although it's taking us longer, that these are going to be necessary in order to hold politicians' feet to the fire, to make them declare climate emergencies and not only make those declarations, but follow up and do the things that are necessary in order to really change the direction of our civilization. And needless to say, it's not an easy thing to do. In fact, it may be the most difficult task that humanity has ever faced. And yet, at this point, I think it's become clear to many of us that we don't have any choice, that the present system is leading us only to disaster. Business as usual, politics as usual, is only going to lead us to ecological and social collapse.
When I look at the statistics, time and again, the statistics show that all of our statements that we receive from the UN and the different international environmental organizations were very, very conservative. They assumed that we would not be having these crises that we're seeing today. Who would have imagined that in July 2019, in Mexico, in one city, there would be 5 feet of ice that came through a storm that no one expected, that had never happened before in history. It's something that you can't imagine, and yet it happened. And so when every single publication for the last 5 years that predicted we don't have to worry because it won't be till 2100 when most people today will be dead, then we'll have to deal with a problem. You don't have to worry about the stability of the great ice sheet on Greenland or the poles. They'll be there. And yet now we're learning that Greenland is losing 500% more ice than what anyone predicted, that the oceans are warming faster, that the Arctic waters are warmer than they've ever been recorded in human history, and that every single prediction made was wrong. And so we don't have that 100 years, and we're talking about getting people to go from voluntary compliance, whole countries, to bring down their fossil fuel emissions. And these countries are at the same time increasing their gross domestic product, meaning they have to keep manufacturing more things, which increase the rate of global warming, for more consumption, so people are not cutting back. People are increasing their consumption, and they're increasing their consumption of unhealthy products to the environment and to their own health. So if the experts were wrong, and they were all wrong, except a handful, and those handful, like Guy McPherson, you will not see any of the major media because he's not willing to sugarcoat the truth. So the only people that you're hearing from are the people who are willing to go along with the idea, don't make people upset. We don't like saying things that cause alarm. We don't want people moving out of states that are flooding or susceptible to hurricanes or all forms of earthquakes, like in, for example, Kansas and Oklahoma from gas hydrofracking, or Colorado. Or they're running out of water, like Colorado and Kansas and 20 other states. 40 million Americans depend upon their water from the Little Colorado, including a lot of people in Southern California, Los Angeles and San Diego, and virtually all of Nevada and a lot of Arizona. Now the snowpacks are not staying in place. They're not as deep and not as frequent. As a result, there's not enough snow to melt to create the water for 40 million people. So what are we doing? We're moving more people into Arizona and Nevada and Southern California and New Mexico, where it's not sustainable because people want to be there. When the oceans are increasing at night with the tide, and that's taking further and further the salt water in and going down into local aquifers, like it's doing, for example, in Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and bringing salt water into the freshwater aquifer, more people are moving to Miami and Fort Lauderdale. So everything that you could do wrong, we're doing wrong. We're not doing anything right. Nothing, not a single administration has had the courage to tell the truth. No governor has told the truth. No legislator has told the truth. So here is the most important issue. The politicians do not unilaterally make decisions. They wait to see the direction they're supposed to go based upon who they're interested in honoring. The electorate? That's rare. Or the people behind the scenes, the powerful corporations and individuals who fund them. That's common. Who are the policymakers and opinion leaders in our society? The same ones in every society throughout history. The mercantile class, the business community, the successful ones, the heads of hedge funds and equity partners, the billionaire class, and Wall Street. It doesn't look whether or not something is good for the environment. It looks whether or not the environment can be a profit stream. It doesn't care about the consequences. Your lawyers, your doctors, your engineers, your scientists, your professors, these are the bourgeois. These are the people that are upper middle class to rich, and they have families. And let's be very conservative and say there are 3 members per family. So if you have, quite simply, 17 million members of the professional class, highly educated, careerists, and successful, and if you have 3 people per family, you're at 51 million people. Now add in the millionaire class of another 10 million, and you're around more or less 60 million people. That's not 1%. That's a huge percentage of our population. And that's why, as we're saying, the economy's booming, it is for those people. It's just not for the rest of people. So when a person says it's really rough to be an average working class person, they are correct. If they say it's really great to have the money to invest in speculative projects, they are also correct. So who decides that we make a Marshall Plan to save the planet? Who decides that we tell people, stop fishing the oceans? They're overfished. Stop using genetically modified crops. Use organic and locally grown to save the soil and your health. And it's always the policymakers who are from that bourgeois class. In history, in France, in the 17th century, you had Louis XIV. Louis XIV was an absolute monarch, and around him was a small group of royals, and they were the privileged ones. They never went hungry. They had everything. They had the money to go where they wanted. Around the royals were the nobility and the aristocracy, and the aristocracy was substantial, and below the aristocracy was the wealth class. And these were the mercantile class. And those classes ruled society at every level. and below them were the working poor in five different classes, from the working poor who could work and did work as craftspersons, masons and plumbers, and mainly in masonry and woodwork and glazing, and they had enough to eat, but nothing to save. But then imagine all the people below them that were poor. So when you look at the people historically who made the decisions, they, the aristocracy, the rich, the powerful, the elitist, brought on the French Revolution, and we know the consequences of that. That was Louis XVI. And so now in the United States, you look at the people who control everything. The people who can fly anywhere, who can have bunkers in case there's a problem with society. They can go to a place and be protected and have all the luxuries of life. And right below them are the aristocracy of America, the celebrities, the people who have massive egos and narcissistic tendencies and are frequently sociopathic. And then below them, you have the educators, and you have the professional class and the business class. Now, that's a lot of people. And how many of those people are saying, what's important is not how much more money I can make or how many more awards I can win, but rather what I can do to share my concern with the rest of the planet and to protect it for future generations. I'm willing to go vegan. I'm willing not to buy anything I don't need. I'm willing to live in a place that is sustainable. How many of those people have said that and then said that to their legislators? I'm not aware of any. You have a sprinkling of celebrities like Arnold Schwarzenegger and a few people who've decided to go vegan, and that's good. But think of all those who are pushing back against that and whose families don't want it. How many teenagers would throw hissy fits if you told them they had to change their diet or stop over-consuming? And you'd ask them, do you care about the environment? Yeah. Are you going to do anything about it? No. So you see, set aside Buddhism, which is a philosophy more than a religion. Set aside massive consumption that we engage in. Set aside people who can't afford to consume but choose to, even when they know that frequently their cars are going to be repossessed and they're going to be in debtors' prisons, or at least up to their eyeballs in debt, and they won't stop consuming. Now please share with me, very pragmatically, not spiritually, pragmatically, who's supposed to save the world? Your thoughts, please.
Well, I really appreciate the connection that you're drawing between, you know, the problem of global heating and the obscenely large gap between rich and poor that's been developing over the last 30 years. Too often, people who see both of the problems don't realize the connection between them. For example, I haven't had a chance to confirm this, but I've read recently that if the top 10% of the world's people lived in the way that the average European does, which is already still quite a nice lifestyle, that we would be able to reduce total carbon emissions by about one-third, which is an extraordinary amount. And another figure that I've come across, again, let me just emphasize, I haven't been able to have the chance to reconfirm it, but it makes sense that the top 10% of the world's population is responsible for about 50% of all of the carbon emissions that are happening. And the bottom 50% of the world's people, which is to say getting close to 4 billion now, that they are responsible for only about 10%. So once again, this shows the connection between the kind of economic system that we have and both sides of it, the preoccupation that we've all, or almost all of us, have had conditioned into us. That is to say, consumption, understanding the meaning of our lives. We're consumers. The point is to buy and consume things on that side, and then the fact that we have institutions and very powerful, wealthy people who benefit from perpetuating that kind of lifestyle. So what seems to me the case is that for those of us who are paying attention, there is a kind of a cognitive dissonance going on, such that we're aware that the ecological situation is very difficult, very threatening, much worse than most of us have realized, and yet we kind of push that off into a corner of our lives, or of our minds, really, and the rest of us we continue living, consuming, thinking about the future in the same way that we have been, and again, we have these strong social, economic, institutional, political forces that encourage us to live with that kind of cognitive dissonance. You ask me specifically, what can we do on a pragmatic level to really address this? And frankly, what I think it's coming down to, Gary, is, two things. First of all, the kinds of ecological disasters that you cited. For example, recently this new heat wave in Spain, in France, for example, or what happened, this incredible hailstorm in Mexico. I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, that those sorts of events are going to happen more and more. And I think the American public, to some degree, those events are causing more and more people to wake up. So it's interesting how opinion polls of, say, those who identify with the Democratic Party, increasingly they are emphasizing that they are concerned about climate change, and they want, for example, the debates to address that. But it's the Democratic National Committee, you know, which is very concerned, more concerned about its relationship with Wall Street, I think. They're the ones who are largely trying to avoid that. They don't want to address it. But the consciousness is growing, and so the reason I emphasize that is what's possible now may be very different from what's possible in the future as these disasters continue to unfold and as more and more people become aware. But the other biggest thing on my mind, frankly, is generational. Gary, you and I, we're of the generation, that incredibly fortunate post-war generation, being able to experience levels of comfort and health such that, you know, none has ever been able to experience that before. And one of the consequences of that, of course, is that we're of an age that we're not going to experience the worst of this. Whereas the really young people, I'm thinking of Greta, you mentioned Greta, who I think is maybe just turning 16. The millennials, the Generation Z, I think these are probably the people that are going to experience, and to some extent are already starting to experience, the change of consciousness. What's noticeable is that, you know, Greta has been inspiring, you know, millions of young people with school strikes. We had a Friday school strike here in Colorado that I attended up at the state capitol some weeks ago. And when you go to Extinction Rebellion events, for example, although there's a fair number of gray hairs like myself, it's quite striking how often that it is the young people taking the lead here. And it seems to me that's where the hope is. It's a matter of talking to them. They can see that the kind of self-indulgent consumerist lifestyle that my generation has been able to afford, that's not going to be there for them. And I think that, quite frankly, that's where the hope lies. I mean, how it's going to unfold, whether they'll be, you know, co-opted in one way or the other, whether they're going to be able to hold politicians' feet to the fire and actually push toward the changes that are necessary, I don't know. I mean, that's part of the great mystery of how all of this is going to unfold. But it seems pretty clear to me that it's the young people that are, because they have the most to lose, and because they're increasingly seeing that, I think that they're the ones that are going to have to take the lead on this. And it's the responsibility of us older folks to support them.
I would agree with that. Thank you very much, David, for coming on today to discuss this demand for a new spiritual ethic I'm hopeful that a lot of the young people won't simply be angry at what they can no longer consume in the same amounts and variety that we've overconsumed, and therefore it is not committed to a deeper spiritual awareness of their interconnectivity to the life process. But we will see that in time. And all the best with your new book, and hope that it is successful. So we look forward to another conversation in the near future.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you for this opportunity.
And my guest today is Professor David Loy, L-O-Y. He's out in Colorado. And his book is Echo Dharma, Buddhist Teachings for the Ecological Crisis. And his website is davidloy.org. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't